This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Sexual harassment and discrimination and assault. The hashtag MeToo has helped launch a movement across the country and internationally that has called out this behavior in a very public way. So much so that Americans are now watching as high-profile men in the news and entertainment fields lose their jobs over sexual misconduct. Just yesterday, Time magazine honored the MeToo movement.
Honestly, I was furious. I had had a man grope me in front of multiple colleagues, and I was tired of wondering if it was something I wore. I was tired of wondering if it was a vibe I was giving off. And when I talked to other women, they were furious too.
That's Adama Uwu, one of more than a dozen women and some men featured in a Time video as the magazine explained its choice for 2017 Person of the Year, calling them the Silence Breakers. They are the people who have spoken publicly about being sexually harassed, discriminated, and abused. Today, Where We Live, we look at the conversations happening in the workplace and at home. Later in the hour, we'll speak with an employment attorney about how employees and employers in any industry should be responding to allegations. What rights do you have if you decide to report a coworker or your boss? We'll find out later. We'll also talk about sexual harassment and discrimination in the academic community. There have been reports at colleges and universities alleging misconduct by professors in recent years, but consequences against the accused haven't taken off to the degree that we've seen in recent days. Why is that? We'll speak to a Yale professor leading a movement for change. We'll find out what steps the sciences are taking to uncover and respond to harassment. That's coming up. But first, you can probably recite the names of powerful men in recent days who no longer have their jobs. Hollywood moguls, news anchors, what about politicians? Members of Congress, including Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, have asked Democratic Senator Al Franken to resign over sexual misconduct. And despite all the allegations against Alabama Senator Hopeful, Republican candidate Roy Moore, members of his party and the RNC continue to support his candidacy. Sexual harassment has dominated news headlines before, but the movement to speak out publicly feels different this time. Why now? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. My first guest is Carrie Baker. She joins us from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst. She's Associate Professor and Director of Study of Women and Gender at Smith College and author of the book, The Women's Movement Against Sexual Harassment. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
As I mentioned, this isn't the first time that sexual harassment and assault has made the headlines. I wanted to go back a little in history. I wanted you to talk about some of the precipitating factors that we've seen that have led to this moment in time.
So the phrase sexual harassment was coined by feminists in Ithaca, New York in 1975. They had these experiences. They got together and began to speak about them and organized against them. They did surveys. They got the data on how widespread it is. And at first people said, oh, this is natural. It's just the way things are. This is how guys are. Or, you know, it's not harmful. This is flirtation. And the women organized and said, no, this is harmful. We're losing jobs. We're, having physical symptoms. And so they began to organize around the issue and turned what really was the norm in the workplace into a federal civil rights violation over between 1975 and 1986. And, you know, awareness was raised and people, began to file lawsuits. But it really wasn't until 1991 when Anita Hill testified before Congress and C-SPAN covered it on cable 24/7. And really the public, it entered public consciousness and awareness was really raised. And there was a lot of legislative and legal and political things that happened in response that I think can give us an idea of what might happen in the coming days and years.
That's interesting that you mentioned access to cable at the time of those confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas when Anita Hill testified. This was something that I remember my parents watching back in 1991, and I wasn't quite sure what was going on, but I remember that being wall-to-wall coverage on television. Fast forward to 2017. I mentioned the hashtag MeToo movement. Social media has really played a role in bringing this to the public. But what were some of the differences of coming out of Anita Hill's testimony back in 91 that we're not seeing today?
So back in 1991, it was one woman's story. The members of the Judiciary Committee did not allow the other women who had complaints against Clarence Thomas to testify. And, you know, she was kind of alone up there. And also it was, you know, it was people you didn't necessarily know who were in the media being talked about. And the thing that's amazing about Me Too is that it's our friends, it's our family members, it's people that we know. And then with social media more generally, you know, we're hearing about so many more stories, and women are connecting and coming together and telling their stories. And it's that's what's always made the difference, is when women act collectively. If it's one woman telling her story, you know, they can try to discredit her and, you know, say, well, she's crazy. But if it's a group of women, it's much harder to discredit. And this goes all the way back to the 70s, but I'm seeing that happening now at a much larger scale, where women are coming together and supporting each other. There's a new website organization called Callisto out in California, where women are reporting their experiences of sexual assault in order to find each other, because often perpetrators are serial perpetrators. And so they're finding others who've been sexually assaulted by the same person, coming together and then stepping forward in a group rather than individually. And I think this is a really important strategy. So my point is, I think technological developments are really important. In the 90s, it was cable. But today, it's the internet, and in particular, social media.
I mentioned, we were talking a little bit decades ago, but when we look at recent years, Carrie, you work at a college, a lot of attention on sexual assault on college campuses. Of course, during the 2016 presidential campaign, the video of Donald Trump saying what he did very graphically to on tape to Access Hollywood about women. How have these all led to this moment in time where people are saying enough is enough?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand that this didn't come out of nowhere, that the women's movement's been working hard on these issues for really, I mean, 42 years since the term was coined, sexual harassment. But there's been a lot of amazing activism going on across the country, particularly on college campuses, but in other places. And I really think that that built the groundwork for what's happening today. You know, certainly when the Department of Education issued really powerful guidelines under the Obama administration, that was in response to students organizing on campuses. When Betsy DeVos, you know, Trump's appointee at the Department of Education, reversed those guidelines, that really mobilizes people. You know, for the Trump administration to go back, you know, when we are finally organizing and speaking out, I think it really angered. I know students are really, really angry about this and organizing and care deeply about this. I think that in the 26 elections, to see Trump get elected after that Access Hollywood video and the allegations against him, you know, it's kind of like Clarence Thomas getting appointed to the Supreme Court after Anita Hill's allegations. I think people are mad. And that anger back in 91 led to a lot of change. And I'm hoping that today's anger will also lead to a lot of change.
I was thinking about the scandal surrounding then-President Bill Clinton and with Monica Lewinsky. Nowadays, we're hearing about members of Congress that have had bad behavior, whether it's sexual harassment or worse. Again, today we're expected to hear what Democratic U.S. Senator Al Franken will be doing, with members of Congress calling on him to resign. But back when President Clinton was in office, did he have more support from the so-called feminists? And is that something that that we're seeing today that's no longer the case, that this is not something that we want to hold on party lines? If this is someone who's doing this, everyone should be held accountable.
Yeah, I was sort of waiting with bated breath to see what would happen around these allegations. And I think it's very stunning that the Democratic Party has come out in such numbers to oppose the Democratic members of Congress, John Conyers and Al Franken. I would just hope that the Republicans would do the same. So far, I'm not seeing that. You know, I guess the Republican National Committee is supporting Roy Moore. Trump has come out in support of Roy Moore. You know, people are not holding Trump himself accountable for his behavior. I would hope this would be a nonpartisan issue. It always has been a partisan issue, within the political context. Sexual harassment in politics goes way back. It's bipartisan. It's one thing that men across partisan lines seem to be able to agree upon, their entitlement to sexually harass and assault women. I think that we need to change that.
Carrie Baker is joining us from the studios of New England Public Radio in Amherst. She's associate professor, director of the study of women and gender at Smith College, also author of the book, The Women's Movement Against Sexual Harassment. Today, we're talking about the Me Too movement, this very public reckoning, so to speak, against inappropriate behavior, whether at the workplace, at a university. Coming up, we'll be speaking to people in the academic community about this very problem, even though today we see a lot of celebrities losing their jobs. If you want to join the conversation to talk about your experience or why you think this moment has really risen to this occasion and why, the number 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. In studio with me is Rosie Enyart, prevention educator and crisis counselor at the Center for Sexual Assault Crisis Counseling and Education in Stanford. Did I get it all, Rosie?
You did.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Again, not a day goes by in the last couple of months where Americans aren't seeing these headlines or talking about it at work or at home. How, from your expertise, when someone who's been traumatized, whether it's been years ago or just last week, when they're seeing this in the news, they're seeing people finally being held accountable, how should people be reacting to that?
Well, I think that many victims who have been silent for many years have felt isolated and alone. And so the Me Too movement, I think, has created space for voices to come together. And I think that, you know, it may have created a sense of taking our power back for a lot of victims.
If someone's listening now and this is calling up, again, these instances in the news is calling up something that's happened to them, where do they turn for help?
There are confidential, free crisis services available all over the state of Connecticut for survivors of sexual harassment and sexual assault. These services are available in many languages. They're completely free, and they're no questions asked support for any survivor.
I had mentioned the attention in recent years on sexual assault on college campuses, and often if someone is a victim or of rape or abuse, often there can be victim blaming. We're not seeing that as much lately. If someone has come forward with allegations, whether it happened again recently or a few years ago, Carrie had mentioned when there is a track record of these kinds of claims, these allegations, people aren't looking to shun and shame the victim anymore. Is that something that you're observing?
You know, it's an interesting observation. I think that I am observing that in what I'm reading. I think maybe the lessened victim blaming has to do with so many voices coming together and speaking up. I think that when one person stands up and shares their story, they're afraid of being asked questions like, well, why were you wearing that? Or, you know, why were you alone with that person in a room? And I think now the collective voice is kind of creating more strength and protection from those questions.
We're going to take some listener calls in just a couple of minutes, but I wanted to ask you, Rosie, when someone harasses someone or abuses someone, it might have been a one-time thing. But for someone that's experienced it, they live with that for every moment of their life. What are the repercussions? What are the signs and symptoms of people that are dealing with this kinds of trauma?
So everyone can be affected differently, but depression and anxiety symptoms are very common, especially if a person is already predisposed to those troubles. A sense of isolation, a deep sense of shame, difficulty returning to work or to school, to class, a feeling of being isolated from one's community. And, you know, these are really difficult things to work with and to walk with. And so sexual harassment absolutely has a long-lasting impact on people.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Dominique is calling from Waterbury. Dominique, go ahead with your question or comment.
Hi. I'm a longtime listener of NPR, and I'm really excited to be on with you today. I recently was empowered to share my story via Facebook after listening to NPR and hearing all these stories about our president endorsing, you know, and the Republican Party endorsing this candidate who is under suspicion. And I just wanted to say that I think this is a really good time for women to come together and empower one another so that we could make great change. I'm a senior social work student at WestCon, and I'm really passionate about policy and advocacy, and I'm just really glad to hear so many people coming out and supporting one another so that we could make something great happen out of this.
Well, Dominique, thank you for your call. Thank you for listening. I wanted to go back to Carrie Baker, Associate Professor, Director of Study of Women and Gender at Smith College. Carrie, do you feel like this moment in time, this movement, has staying power?
I think it will have a tremendous impact. If you go back to the 1991 Anita Hill hearings, some of the things that happened after that is that women ran for public office in record numbers. They called it the Year of the Women. The number of women who ran for Congress doubled, and the number of women in the Senate tripled. And you had that happening also at state houses across the country. Well, right now, you look at the number of women planning to run for office in the 2018 elections, and it's already an astronomical number of women. So I can feel pretty confident that there's going to be a lot more women in public office than there was one year ago. There are also legal implications after what happened with Anita Hill. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1991, which created punitive damages for sexual harassment claims. Right now, the women's movement is asking for things like the elimination of non-disclosure clauses that allow people like Harvey Weinstein to do this behavior over and over again. The elimination of a cap on punitive damages for federal civil rights sexual harassment claims. Even the ERA, there are all these claims that women are now focused on to try to pass to enhance their legal status. And finally, after 1991, women filed lawsuits for sexual harassment in record numbers. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission filings doubled within several years after Anita Hill. Women began filing lawsuits, and people were afraid that the treatment of Anita Hill would discourage people. It didn't. It mobilized women. And so I can pretty much guarantee you that the number of lawsuits filed and claims made for sexual harassment is going to go up tremendously in response to what's happening right now because of the increased awareness that this is wrong, awareness that they have legal rights and that they can sue, and support for them to do this.
Who are the voices that are being left out of this conversation? Again, we're looking at high-profile men in the entertainment and media world. If someone is working at a small company or working in the service industry, you know, what recourse do they have?
So, you know, certainly celebrities were the ones that got this out there first. And I was discouraged at first because we were only hearing from a lot of celebrities and, you know, people were listening to them. And I'm like, well, you know, the sexual harassment movement back in the 70s was led by women of color. It was led by women on construction sites. And that's what the focus of my book is. And I know that women of color have always been leaders in this movement. And I was asking, where were they? And I was encouraged yesterday to see the Time magazine Person of the Year, the Silence Breakers, that there were a lot there's a broader representation of women in that group. And it was interesting to me to hear that the person that started Me Too was an African-American woman named Tarana Burke. And she created this hashtag or this movement in 2006. And it was about sharing with each other what had happened and acting collectively. And I think that women, this will have an impact on women across the fields, not just in media and politics. I talked to some construction workers yesterday who said that there are a lot more conversations going on in construction work sites than there were, you know, a year ago.
Again, you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Derek is calling from Windsor. Derek, go ahead.
Yeah, Lucy, thank you very much for this topic. And I just want to make a point that I want to applaud the women first for coming out. And it's a long time coming. And, you know, but for this issue to become a zero tolerance, I think they're going to have need the support of real men. You know, when I say real men, men that's not doing this kind of thing, when they see this kind of thing, they got to help the woman by speaking up against these kind of issues. And the next point I want to make is that what's the real repercussion? Because people like Bill O'Reilly, I understand that another network has picked him up and give him job, something of the sort. And if that's the case, how do we get to the bottom of this issue? Because if you can commit an offense and then some other network is going to give you a bigger, probably even a bigger job, then, I mean, it's not really going to send a message.
Well, Derek, very good point. We appreciate your call. Kerry Baker, I'll go back to you. Let's talk about the role men have to play at this moment in time.
I think bystanders have a tremendous role to play. Within the context of sexual assault, for a long time, activists have talked about the importance of bystander intervention, which means if you see something, say something, intervene. And I think men in particular have an important role as bystanders and as, you know, talking with other men and not allowing this, as Trump says, locker room behavior. You know, the locker room needs to change. And I think that, as the caller said, good men need to take a leadership role. Men have actually been very active on sexual assault. Groups like Men Stopping Rape, people like Jackson Katz, other activists who have spoken out against sexual assault and worked to educate other men. That needs to expand. I think men need to organize, get politically active and active in their communities to educate other men and to be role models for each other.
Kerry Baker is a women's studies professor at Smith College, author of The Women's Movement Against Sexual Harassment. She joined us today from New England Public Radio. Kerry, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, what's it like to start a career at a university when a faculty mentor becomes a harasser? Has this happened to you? You can join the conversation. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, what rights do you have in the workplace if you've been sexually harassed or discriminated against? Employment attorney Jared Lucan joins us later this hour. Now, news personalities, entertainment celebrities, and politicians are in the news over sexual misconduct. Harassment happens across any employment field, against women and men. But changes to a workplace culture within different fields can be slow going. Take, for instance, in the academic world. Our next guest can talk about the experiences on college and university campuses and what should be done to change the culture. Joining me now by phone, Linda Wang, senior editor at Chemical and Engineering News. She and co-author Andrea Widener wrote a cover story about sexual harassment in chemistry departments for the magazine. Linda, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So first, walk us through what prompted you and your co-author to write this story. And what have you been hearing among women who are in the chemistry fields around the country?
Yeah, so this was prompted about a year ago when we started hearing, you know, other faculty members accused of sexual harassment in, for example, astronomy and, you know, other fields. And we were wondering what the prevalences of sexual harassment in the chemistry field. And as we were starting to do our research and we were reaching out to the community to find out, you know, how prevalent this is, we got a large response. We asked the community, you know, people could step up and tell us their stories. And we got almost a dozen women coming to us telling us about their experience with sexual harassment in their chemistry department. Most of these are graduate students, some postdocs, and we also had some people who are early in their careers talking about what they faced when they were, you know, what they faced in their departments. And so we looked into it and we realized that this is a big problem. We had looked into some of the statistics, and in academia, a 2015 survey by the American Association of American Universities showed that of 27 research universities, 62% of female undergraduate and 44% of female graduate students experienced sexual harassment. And for graduate students, the perpetrator was most likely a faculty member or advisor, while for undergraduates, the perpetrator was most likely a fellow student. Mm-hmm. And another recent survey that we found from the National Postdoctoral Association showed that 700 women and men were harassed out of more than 2,700 postdocs who responded to the survey.
Linda, on your in your article, again, this is the cover story of the September 18th magazine, Chemical and Engineering News. If you go on your website, there are clips of these actual women who wanted to remain anonymous, but they're talking about what happened to them. We wanted to play one of those clips now.
Eventually, he decided to take me to a conference. While we were driving, at some point, he started touching me inappropriately. His hand was on my leg. What do? Do you jump out of the car? You can't do that. We check in at the hotel, and he said, we should share a room, because it's cheaper on the grant. Then, when we were at the conference, I was hanging out with the graduate students and other professors. He was jealous, like I was dating him. He explicitly told me, if you were not my student, I would have fallen in love with you. And he was married.
So this was a former graduate student talking about a professor in her research group. Linda, you recited some stats earlier that are troubling about how many female undergrad and graduate students experience harassment. But unlike a traditional workplace, can we talk about some of the challenges of the academic setting, where if something like this is happening, what recourse do they have?
Yeah, I think a lot of women found that they don't have much recourse. Especially for graduate students, they're under the their mentor for about 4 years, and a lot of universities it's unclear what to do if you're experiencing sexual harassment. And a lot of times, I think, women end up blaming themselves. They think, some of the women that we talked to, they wondered if they wore, maybe it's because of the tennis shorts that they wore into the lab, or I think they it's almost psychological that they believe that, something that they did. They wonder they're worried that nobody will believe them, or they're embarrassed that something like this could happen to them. One woman that we talked to, she said that the shame of being involved in a harassment situation is overwhelming. You don't want anyone to know because they wonder how a smart woman could ever get into a situation like this. Also, they're worried about retaliation. I think, a lot of times they depend on their mentors for recommendations, and it's a very small community. So they're worried that, if they say anything, that the rest of their career will be, will be damaged.
And you talk to women who, because of what they experienced, instead of trying to continue with their careers, they ended up dropping out.
Yeah, that happens a lot, actually. I think, sexual harassment, unfortunately, may be one of the reasons why there are few women in the sciences. Many of the women told us that because of the environment that they experienced, that they can continue. Many of them did drop out of their PhD programs, or now, they're in different fields altogether.
We're getting a tweet from a listener, Annie, who writes, there's a larger culture of entitlement and residue of an old boys club still in academia. In graduate school, I was harassed by an older tenured professor, and I met another person he was inappropriate with over time. He's still teaching today. I wanted to bring into the conversation now Aisha Ramachandran, assistant professor of comparative literature and director of graduate studies for comparative literature at Yale University. Aisha, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me.
What kinds of conversations are faculty and students having at Yale University about sexual harassment and discrimination today?
Well, as you probably know, and very publicly, Yale has been torn apart by a lot of these allegations over the last several years. And on the one hand, much of what you've already discussed on the program happens here, inappropriate behaviors, entitlement that leads tenured and non-tenured faculty members to assault or harass younger students. On the other hand, I also think that there is a very strong awareness of the persistent culture that makes possible these kinds of behaviors and ways in which we can begin to change that. So Yale, for instance, has a quite strong women's faculty forum that does organize discussions and support groups and means of communication that make possible and more legible ways for people to report and then to deal with the fallout of having been harassed or aggressed upon. We've looked into organizing more grassroots conversations around lunches with graduate students and younger faculty and postdocs around these kinds of situations and issues to think more about what actually can be done. And as your earlier speaker was saying, Yale has actually invested quite a lot in bystander intervention training. This has worked extremely well at the undergraduate level, and it's now voluntarily available to graduate students and faculty and staff. And a large number, I think close to 1,000 people, have been trained over the last couple of years to be better bystanders, which can actually make substantial differences.
A listener tweeted at us, "I'm waiting for the sexual harassment and assault purge to reach higher education." Aisha, again, you're a staff member at Yale University. This is a question that you and another colleague raised in an op-ed in the Washington Post. Do you think that it will rise to the occasion?
Well, I think that we are seeing much of the same calling out that we've seen publicly in other industries within the academic world. I mean, the Chronicle for Higher Education has been full of articles about this. We've seen it more publicly in more mainstream venues. Many small niche publications have seen people come out and really call out at pretty gruesome length things that happened to them, including rape and assault. So I do think that the Me Too movement has certainly reached the academic world. I think the bigger question is, I mean, two things, really. One is, what if anything will actually happen? I think once again, there is a call to punish and bring appropriate penalties to really high profile perpetrators, which is important. But the bigger question on the ground is, how are we going to change an inbred culture, a culture that is so entangled and intimate in the ways in which it behaves and blurs the lines between professional and personal and social interactions? And how are we going to change that culture in a way that in a generation will mean that we don't see this anymore?
Aisha, you mentioned blurred lines. Let's talk about that a little further, this relationship between grad students and professors and why it's so difficult.
So let me give you a very practical example. We often think of teaching as happening within classrooms, but both at the undergraduate and especially the graduate level, a seminar might be meet for 2 hours in a classroom once a week, but there is a lot of interaction that happens in faculty offices, in hallways, in public lectures, and then the lunches or dinners that follow them, in conversations that can go on over drinks, especially over coffee in cafes that can linger for hours and that are often difficult for students to disentangle themselves. So there is an entire intellectual culture that actually takes place, I would say, in richer ways outside the classroom than in the classroom. And what this means is that often one's social life and one's intellectual life, which is also one's professional life, are thoroughly enmeshed. And it's not clear where you draw a line between a conversation that is about your dissertation chapter and an exciting conversation about, say, you know, love poetry that you might be having with a tenured faculty member.
This is Where We Live. Today we're talking about sexual harassment and discrimination in 2017. On the phone with me, Aisha Ramachandran, an assistant professor of comparative literature and director of graduate studies for comparative literature at Yale University. Also, Linda Wang, senior editor at Chemical and Engineering News. She and co-author Andrea Widener wrote a cover story about sexual harassment in chemistry departments around the country. Linda, I wanted to go back to you. We know that this department, especially chemistry, science, is extremely male-dominated. Can we talk a little bit further about what steps are being taken to address this? I understand that the National Sciences has a panel looking at harassment now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of societies are looking into this issue, and there's been a number of workshops. The American Chemical Society also is taking this issue very seriously, and we are having a full-day symposium on sexual harassment. It's the first of this kind for our society at our March national meeting in New Orleans. And we're also going to be having a bystander training workshop. So it's something that I think, you know, more and more societies and more funding agencies are looking into.
You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Meg is calling from Madison. Meg, go ahead with your question or comment.
Well, my comment fits right into what you were talking about, which is that besides, I'm heartened to hear that people are organizing around this issue, but in my experience, and the obvious example is, in fact, Clarence Thomas, women complain, bring a case, and the man is promoted to a position of higher power. this happens repeatedly. I saw that frequently in my own career. And it's very disheartening. And if people want to know why women don't come, haven't come forward, it's an obvious reason why. Not only will they be denigrated, but their abuser will be elevated or promoted. That's a common thing. And it has to, you know, if you really want to change the culture, that has to stop. People have to have consequences and not be promoted to a position of power after they have been known to be sexual harassers.
Thank you, Meg, for your comment. Aisha, I wanted to go back to you in terms of we were talking about the relationship between students and professors. When someone has tenure and someone doesn't, if that other person that's in the higher position is harassing, you know, what recourse can they take?
This is a great and complicated question, and I think that your caller is exactly right, that it is very disheartening, especially within academic settings, to see people go unpunished and remain secure despite real abuses. There are actual procedures. Different universities set them up differently under Connecticut law, and certainly within Yale, for instance. Any faculty member is a mandatory reporter, which is to say that if I heard from a student or a colleague that there had been something around the issue of sexual harassment that had taken place, I am required to report it to our Title IX coordinator. Confidentiality can be maintained, and this doesn't mean that somebody has to actually bring a complaint. The problem is many people, there's a culture, I think, of disinformation around what reporting and actually entails, and a lot of people with very good reason fear retaliation and don't come forward. I will also say that when my colleague and I wanted to publish our op-ed, we were counseled by various people that this may not be very smart for us, since we are not tenured at the moment. On the other hand, I think that there are a lot of people who do want to actually bring about change, but depend on people being able to speak up, to report through these various channels internally, whether or not they actually bring complaints, because this documents a persistent culture that a university can potentially then take steps to reverse or to address in various ways. So I do think that there is the double problem of a culture of fear, but also then disinformation around what actually are procedures that do exist, as they do at various universities, to support people who may want to come forward.
You had mentioned, Aisha, a little bit earlier, some high-profile instances at Yale University. I know at the School of Medicine, also there was a story, I think a couple years ago, about a very famous philosophy professor at Yale. I understand that Yale University has a university-wide committee on sexual misconduct. We did reach out to Yale University to talk about this system in place. Before we head to break, Aisha, the climate at Yale University, are people confident in the systems that are in place now to root out the behavior?
I think confidence is a big word. I think that this moment has made people feel galvanized about speaking out more and learning more. I mean, to give you a concrete example, in our own department, we did a series of workshops and trainings this semester, and a lot of students who had felt disheartened and not at all confident in the shape of the university's procedures have come to me and said they were surprised to learn that actually there were things in place that they did not think were in place. The challenge that does remain is sexual harassment, especially when it doesn't rise to the level of a criminal offense, of assault, is really difficult to adjudicate. And I think that because there are so many blurry lines and gray areas in the academic world, the kinds of cases that are not clear assault and criminal cases, and even those cases are difficult, make it very, very hard for people to both come forward and then have their concerns adequately addressed. So while your earlier speaker was talking about legal protections in place, and there are increasingly more legal protections, the problem is when you don't have a clear-cut case, which is often the case in the academic world, and it's difficult to prove because it's what one person said versus what another person said, we get into a culture in which people are not sure who to trust and what they can say. So I think Yale is really combating this kind of complex situation where they would like to give people more confidence. I think increasingly more women in positions of administrative control and power is a good sign. But I think we have a long way to go.
We'll have to leave it there. Aisha Ramachandran, Assistant Professor of Comparative Literature and Director of Graduate Studies for Comparative Literature at Yale University. Thank you, Aisha, for your time.
Thanks so much, Lucy.
Also, Linda Wang, senior editor at Chemical and Engineering News. She and co-author Andrea Widener wrote a cover story about sexual harassment in chemistry departments nationwide. We'll tweet out a link to that extensive report. Linda, thank you for your time as well.
Thank you so much, Lucy.
Coming up, we're going to talk about, again, what protections you have in the workplace with an employment attorney. Also in studio with us, Rosie Enyart, prevention educator and crisis counselor at the Center for Sexual Assault Crisis Counseling and Education in Stanford. And we'll continue to take your calls, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up tomorrow, the National Football League. Each week, these athletes entertain millions. In recent years, the image of the NFL has darkened for a number of reasons, including reports about a brain disease known as CTE. On the next Where We Live, we're going to talk about that, and we want to hear from you. Have your views changed on football? That's join the conversation tomorrow on Where We Live. Now, big corporations and news organizations have been busy firing powerful men in recent weeks after allegations of sexual misconduct. But what if you work for a small employer? What if it's your manager or boss who's harassing you? Do you worry about losing your job if you report them? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Joining me now in studio is Jared Lucan, labor employment attorney at Shipman and Goodwin LLP. Jared, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You understand the laws related to sexual harassment and discrimination in the workplace. What are the protections that individuals should know exist not only in Connecticut but federally, and how should employers be responding today?
Well, the protection that exists for employees are set forth both in federal and our state law. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act is the federal law that protects against harassment in the workplace. That applies to employers that employ more than 15 or more employees. On the side of that, we have our state Connecticut Fair Employment Practices Act, which applies to employers that employ three or more. Both statutes prohibit harassment within the workplace. They set forth a definition, or at least the Connecticut law sets forth a definition of harassment in the workplace. And in Connecticut, at least, I think what's important and what we try to express to employers is that there's a aiding and abetting provision. Meaning that if managers allow harassment to happen in the workplace, are complicit in it in some way, know about it and fail to take the appropriate actions. We talked a little bit about bystander training and I think it was Carrie that raised that. If they know about it and don't do something about it, there can be individual liability. And we express that to our employers because I think that makes, you know, the training and the prevention aspect of this a little more real for people, knowing that it's not just my company that might be liable, but me as myself as a manager might be liable too for these actions.
If we know that there are protections in place under the Civil Rights Act, and over the years employers have sexual harassment training in place, why is it not effective? What are some of the reasons this continues to happen, Jared?
And so that's a really good question. It's something that we as a firm have also been thinking about with our clients in terms of what can we do to provide sort of, again, we emphasize the prevention, and all employers should be emphasizing the prevention aspect of things and trying to get to a point where you're not dealing with what we're seeing now in the media, right? And I should say, going back to your original question, all the standards that we talk about, the laws, they protect employers of all sizes, okay? So with respect to the training itself, you know, some training, you know, people have sort of just checked off a box that we've done it and then we move on. We find that training that isn't boring is helpful. So having actual real-life examples, using technology to get people interactive, making sure that the managers and their supervisors know what is your policy as an employer, how do you implement it, what things should you be looking for, giving examples of those type of things in an industry-specific way, so that if you're doing training for, let's say, a school board of some kind, you're not giving examples of what happens at a law firm, right? You want to give examples of what you might face every day in your job. And that makes it, I think, more real. And so in terms of why trainings aren't working, I think, one, some trainings are boring, right? I mean, I think we've all sat there in front of a TV screen and just clicked the button and said, I'm done. Other thing is that they don't emphasize the fact that there's a practical definition of harassment as well, and that is that it's essentially power expressed sexually, right? It's not necessarily ever about sex. It's also about power. It's about demeaning someone in their self-worth because of their gender. And so the focus on that power aspect and how do we change the culture from an employer standpoint that these things aren't happening, mm-hmm. right? And so we focus on that. We focus on the complaint procedures because as an employer, you can only take action when you know about something. And we heard a lot about the fears of retaliation. We hear from the other guests about people not wanting to come forward. And that's true, right? The statistics show that people don't come forward for fears of retaliation. And so when you're emphasizing the training and you want to emphasize to your employees, these things exist to protect you. But it also starts from the employer taking action in terms of its culture, mm-hmm. right? And stopping it from the top down to prevent these things from getting out of control.
Now that we're seeing this onslaught of headlines that very high-profile people are losing their job over allegations, they're in the conversation, there is the question, naturally, well, if it's an allegation, why are people losing their job?
And I think that's it's interesting, right? Because we sort of emphasize, and I would say, you know, you don't want to rush to any conclusion. You don't want to jump to a conclusion. And you're absolutely right. I mean, these things are allegations. We heard, you know, Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill. Those are allegations. There's two people that know what happened, Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill. The stress, though, is, A, once we know about something or should have known about something, don't jump to that conclusion. It might ultimately end up being that somebody has done the harassment, that the allegations are true, and you take whatever necessary action. But as an employer, you want to say, okay, I have a complaint now or I know about something. What should I do? Let me look into it. Let me figure out what happened. Let me talk to the right people and let me put the pieces together to determine, is this accurate? Is it not? Is it a misunderstanding? Is it not? I'm not saying that harassment doesn't happen because we all know that it does. But just to say we have these allegations, they're so bad we have to fire someone. I think it just depends on the situation, right? If you're a mom and pop shop in Connecticut, maybe you're not going to be on CNN every day if you don't necessarily terminate someone right away. You know, we look at the reaction to the allegations against Matt Lauer, it was immediate termination. And so I think you have to look at the situation as well. But I would also just caution not to just rush in and make a decision without looking at the situation.
In recent weeks, Jared, we're hearing a lot about the role of confidentiality agreements, mandatory arbitration agreements. Is this something that employers are not going to take seriously, or are they going to still stick with these agreements, given the controversy?
Well, I think until there's a shift in the law, that employers are likely going to keep them in their agreements. And the reason for it is exactly what we're talking about. Generally, these are allegations. And simply because a company decides for better or worse to settle a matter rather than fight it out in court or fight it out in the court of public opinion, because we are talking about reputation of companies out there as well, we do include employers do include confidentiality provisions within any settlement agreement that they might have. And the reason being is that this should be confidential. We don't know. It hasn't factually been heard by a jury to say we did something wrong. And we're trying to avoid getting to that place.
Yeah. A part of this movement are people are brave enough to come forward and be public. And if people are protected in confidentiality agreements, there's always not accountability.
That is true, right? So the question is, how do you know about these things going on when people aren't allowed to speak about them? And the answer to really from our perspective and from my perspective is it just needs to stop from an inside out, right? So if a company knows these things are happening, it should know that these are illegal. It should know that this shouldn't be happening, right? You don't want to get to the point where your company logo's on whatever news channel it is that night and in the news cycle. And so taking those actions to prevent it to begin with is the right way to go.
That's Jared Lucan, labor employment attorney at Shipman and Goodwin, LLP. Rosie Enyart was in studio with me as well, prevention educator and crisis counselor at the Center for Sexual Assault Crisis Counseling and Education in Stanford. Rosie, I just wanted to throw a quick question to you from a listener. She wants to know what advice can you give to combat narratives that people falsely accuse? How do we engage in conversation with people who minimize this movement that's happening today?
Well, I think it's important to know that that false allegations of sexual harassment are really a myth. You know, they exist at a very small margin. And we really need to put the shame on the perpetrators of these types of misconducts.
Well, I want to thank you, Rosie, again, from coming in up from Stanford. Also, Jared Lucan, a lot to cover in just a short amount of time, but you did a great job. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you.
Today's show produced by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to WNPR intern Sarah Bly. Too bad we ran out of time. This is an engaging conversation. We hope to continue it in the future. Also, thanks to technical producer Kyone Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. As always, thanks for listening.